Hello and welcome to the Truth Alone podcast. My name is Justin Moranti. I'm here with my father, Robin Moranti, and we want to thank you so much for joining us. We also want to give a quick shout out to everyone at Canyon Springs Church in Middleton, Idaho, and also to those of you at Family Heritage Church in La Quinta, California. Thanks to all of you who have encouraged us while we've been putting this together. For those of you who just come across this podcast, let me set it up for you. We're going to be dealing primarily with the topic of information science and how it relates to a biblical worldview. Now, some of you might be asking, why information science? What's so special about that? And to answer that, I'm going to quote John MacArthur. In his series he did a while back, it was called The Battle for the Beginning. He says that information science is what is bringing down the theory of evolution. And now that might seem like a bold statement, but as we get further ahead, you're going to see why that's true. So that coupled with the fact that it's a relatively new and unexplored area of study for a lot of people means that it's worth a deeper look. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to look deeply into this really interesting field of study. So we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Now, we do have a website. You can go to www.truthalone.org. And that's where we're going to be posting our blogs and links to the various resources we reference, whether they be books, articles, videos, what have you. Right now, I think there's quite a few books on the site already. Our first blog is up as well. It's on the topic of pride. So I hope you'll check that out. Also, if you would like to contact us, there's a link on the website for that as well. So again, that's www.truthalone.org. Now we're going to do something that might seem a little different. For this first episode, we're going to go back in time. And we're going to look at the history of information itself, how the speed of information and the dissemination of it has changed over time, especially with technology increasing the way it has. And that might seem like a daunting task, and it kind of is. So that's why we're going to devote an entire episode to it. But I think you'll find it fascinating. To start us out on our journey, let me introduce you to my dad. Dad, did you want to get us going?
Yes, thanks, Justin. So I first want to second what Justin has just said and perhaps add one item. And that item I'd like to add is that it is our intent to get to the bottom of what is information exactly. And I think we're going to get to a level over the next couple of episodes that you, the listener, perhaps have never given thought. And I know that before we, Justin and I, ventured into all of this, that I personally had never considered information to the level of which I am referring. Now, it is easy to define what we think information to be, but it's when we start breaking it down and getting into some of the finer characteristics of information that we start to realize that this entity that we think to be so tangible suddenly begins to lose that tangibility. Mm-hmm. Now, I may be jumping ahead a little bit too much too soon, hoping maybe to whet your appetite, but what we will need to do is start with an overview of recent technological advances. And now when I say recent, I am talking about over the last couple centuries. And I realize that doesn't sound all that recent to most of us because very few of us live to be a century old, let alone a couple centuries. Mm-hmm. But in order to understand the connection between technology and creative information, it is important to go back a couple centuries because it's during that span of time that there have been advancements in technology that do propose challenges to today's paradigm.
And let me just add one thing there. Mm-hmm. For those of you that read a lot of history or are interested in history, you know that we tend to be prisoners of our own time. And it's when you take a step back and look at the big picture that things really, what typically happens is we realize that everything we kind of, our presuppositions were off. So that's another reason for kind of going back for this first episode and really taking a big picture look at a lot of things that we take for granted. And hopefully as you listen to this, you'll that will become more clear. So stick with us because this is going to get interesting. So go ahead, Ned.
Yeah, that is a very good point, Justin. You said the big picture. When you start to see all these events, because we tend to not think back into past events, and we'll get more into that as we proceed here, but the big picture kind of brings things into perspective. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I'm going to explain this, is that we have entitled this podcast series, and when I say series, I'm talking about more than one episode, as being relevant to information science, and I want to ensure everyone that that's exactly what this is. But this first episode is going to be more of a history addressing technologies pertaining to the moving around of information. Mm-hmm. So these first examples may seem that they have little to do with science. We ask you to bear with us, hopefully in upcoming episodes as well, because as I said at the beginning, our intention is to get to the bottom of what is information. And we're going to see that it may not be what you think it to be. It may not be as quite as simple as what you think it is. And what I mean by that is that I think most of us has this concept of information as being of what information that is, or in my case was at least, not exactly all comprehensive, not all inclusive. So if you stick with us and with the series, this will make more sense down the road. So though this first episode of the podcast may not seem to be addressing anything scientific, we will be introducing the Department of Information Science in the following episode, and then be directing the discussion toward the information as it's being scientifically researched in today's biological circles. So that being said, I'm going to start out by saying this, is that we live in a highly technological age. And I think it'll sound redundant to say this, the following, and that is that things have not always been the way they are today. And I think everyone will agree with that, pretty much. Younger generation may not understand that yet, but
yeah, again, we're all prisoners of our time, but
yeah,
I think everyone does intuitively get that on some level.
Yeah. I'm going to be addressing some of that a little bit here shortly in this episode. Mm-hmm. But to even say that it's highly technological is a relative statement. And because what we think of as state of the art today, tomorrow may seem commonplace. And if not tomorrow, sometime very soon. And I can give you an example of this. Just a couple of weeks ago, my brother, he sent me a text inviting myself and my wife to join him and his wife in a Zoom meeting. And right there, Zoom, for me, is a relatively new technology. It wasn't around a couple decades ago. But what he wanted to do was to share some photos that he had digitized that my grandfather had taken back in the 1950s when we lived in Los Angeles. And when I say we lived in Los Angeles, my brother didn't live there. He wasn't born yet. He's quite a bit younger than I am. But there really are two examples that I can extract for you from this one scenario. And the first being that my grandfather, he was sort of a camera buff, and he liked to take pictures of the family. And he was always taking pictures, but he took these pictures with what at that time was considered a state-of-the-art camera. Now, what was that term you called the
He's an early adopter, basically, what we would call an early adopter. Latest thing comes out, and he's got to have it, basically.
And I had never, this was back in the 1950s, so I had never heard of that term. It wasn't even a term back then.
But it did exist, obviously.
I think he fit into that classification. But anyway, he liked to take pictures with what was considered a state-of-the-art camera of that time, but today it would not be worthy of that title. Mm-hmm. And firstly, because it made use of a technology of that time is used less and less today, that being something called photographic film. Now, I know that photographic film is still around today. You could just call it film or whatever. But I believe for the most part, it's on its way out. It's being replaced in a big way by the digital camera and the digital world, and for several advantageous reasons. But the film that was used in a camera came on spools, and these spools would fit nicely into a camera. So right there, again, for the newer generations, right there, that might be something that would be considered inconvenient, because it would pretty much eliminate the possibility or probability of selfies, unless your cell phone was bigger, which they used to be a lot bigger. But
I think that would be devastating to a lot of people.
Yeah.
No selfies.
I couldn't put it in my pocket like I do today. But the film itself was made of a clear, sort of thin but rollable material with a special paper backing. And it's hard for me to think of a substance that we have today that would fit that description other than microfiche. But even microfiche is kind of going out of style. Mm-hmm. But if you come in contact with a microfiche machine, you'd look at the microfiche. The substance that's the image is printed on is basically what film is. But this film was coated on one side with silver oxide, and the silver oxide was light sensitive. And because it was light sensitive, and you had to load it into your camera, you had to go indoors out of direct sunlight so as to not expose that film to too much light, because it would ruin the film. So we would load the film indoors, and we go into a room and pull the shades down just to not allow too much light in. So when you're loading the film, the first thing you would do is take the back of the camera off, which there were latches on either side of the camera. And at that point, you could see inside the camera. On the left side, you'd see like a small little cavern where the spool would fit nicely in there and snap in into place. And there was a loose end of the film. So you would take that film and draw it out over across the back of the camera into the empty spool that would be on the right side of the camera. And then you could take up the slack with a little knob on the bottom of the camera. Mm-hmm. I call that portion of the camera the exposure chamber, because it was kind of a light tight chamber once you close the camera up, where when you depress the shutter button, the shutter opens and closes very quickly, as you know, just like a digital camera, but the light would enter the camera and expose the film. Whatever you're pointing the film at, that image would be impressed on the film.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this. Like, some people are probably, you're bringing back a lot of memories. Like, they're probably like, yeah, I remember that. And then there's other people that probably have no idea what you're talking about. But
yeah, I'm sorry about that part.
That gives you an idea how fast some of this stuff has changed.
Some of this stuff is, yeah, just, and all these things that we're going to be discussing have happened over the last couple of centuries. So it's necessary to go back a couple of centuries, because we're going to get to some older technologies that impacted information dissemination. But
in fact, real quick, you mentioned Zoom.
Yeah.
Earlier. Most people, I would guess, probably had never even heard of Zoom until last year when the pandemic happened.
That's true.
Obviously, Skype's been around and some of those kinds of technologies, but
right,
that's how quickly, and now everybody knows what Zoom is. So
yeah, and just to your point, my wife, she works from home now, and has been for the last couple of years because of COVID. She'll be in these meetings. Sometimes it's all day meetings, but they're all conducted over Zoom.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the pandemic has kind of brought
radically
Zoom to
things.
Light. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So once you've loaded the camera and you got the film in the camera, you can go out and take pictures. And this was my grandfather's camera now. So what you would do, and for the sake of this illustration, I'm going to say that one of the characteristics of using film is that it was limited as to how many pictures you could take with a roll of film. It wasn't like the digital cameras where you have a SIMS card or something in your camera. You can take hundreds of pictures on the card to use up all the memory. Back then, the film was restricted to maybe anywhere between 10 and 100 pictures. And for the sake of this illustration, I'm going to use 25. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say the film could handle 25 pictures. Once you put the back of the camera back on, you would see and you would advance the film until there was a little window on the back of the camera that was about a quarter inch square, and it would display a number when you advance the film. And when you get to the number one, that would mean that the first exposure frame, more or less, was in place. So you could go out and take picture number one. Now, when you got to number 25, like I said, this film was long enough to hold 25 pictures. Get to number five, you know that's your last picture that you can take with this roll of film. Right. So you would take that picture, and once you did that, you'd take the film back into the house, open the back of the camera, back into that little not-so-bright room, and you would slip the roll of film back into the packaging that you purchased it in, and it was light-tight as well, and you could just seal it. And you'd take it down to your trusted Photoshop. So when I say Photoshop, I have to tell you this. I'm not referring to Photoshop in the sense of the word that we use it today. I know that Photoshop is a software, but it's also become a verb, and we use that software as a verb to say we're going to Photoshop this image, you know.
Right.
And you use the Photoshop software to alter the picture in some way or to enhance it. Mm-hmm. But in those days, in the 1950s now, Photoshop was actually a place of business, a physical place. It was a place where you could go in and buy a camera, or you could buy film for your camera, Or in the case of this illustration, you could take your exposed film and get the film developed, something we don't have to do today with the digital camera.
Right.
Now, it would usually take a couple days for you to get your film developed and to go back and be able to view it.
That's another thing that would be, I think, inconceivable to the generation you mentioned, and we'll say Generation Z or the millennial generation, where one of the, and this is obviously well documented, so I'm not saying anything here that's new, but one of the effects of all this technology and the speed of technology changing the way it has is sort of the shortened attention span and the instant gratification culture that we have. And it's affected all of the generations alive today, but I think mostly it's affected that younger generation that you referred to. To think of waiting for your pictures to develop 3 or 4 days, I think it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their mind around.
Yeah, and you know what? I have to confess, I'm of the older generation, and I've become used to not waiting.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, yeah. I like the digital pictures for that reason, is that you can get instant feedback.
Right.
So, which brings up my next point, is that the fact that the pictures may not have come out, because some of these pictures, like we have a roll of 25 pictures, and because you're limited to the 25, you weren't in the habit of just going out and shooting 25 pictures, you know, in succession. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these rolls of film would be in the camera for a couple months.
Right.
So you might have pictures in there you took a couple months ago or just even last month, and you don't remember what's on the film. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of exciting. The fact that you didn't know how the pictures came out was always a possibility, but yeah. you didn't know that till you went and picked up the pictures, took them out to your car, opened the package, and actually looked at them. And then it reminds you of, oh, yeah, remember we did this last month, 2 months ago?
Yeah.
It was kind of fun. It added that anticipation.
I was just going to say that. There's something that gets, just like with all technology, there's something that gets lost sometimes with the, when things advance and, you know, you certainly have the increase of convenience, but a lot of times things get lost. I was talking to my brother the other day, and we were talking about videos and how we used to rent videos at the store, and how it would be, you know, certainly not as convenient because you had to actually physically go to the Blockbuster or whatever and find the videos
and look for something, right?
Yeah, but there was something about doing it together. You know, there was a bonding element to it, and then there was sort of that commitment that you would mm-hmm. make to a movie. Like if you went to the trouble of renting a movie in the store, like there was a commitment. Be a little added pressure to actually watch the movie and pick a good movie, as opposed to at home where you can pick anything you want and watch it instantly. You could end up going through a lot of garbage before you come to something good, you know. Uh-huh. So those experiences kind of get lost with technology, and this is another example with the photos, I think.
That's true. Things change, but not necessarily a bad thing, but
right.
But like you said, we just lose little things. Like you said, just being in the Blockbuster, as you used the example, and looking for something, and then being able to, and seeing something maybe you're interested in, you can say, "Hey, Jared, come on over here, and you want to watch this?" You know.
Yeah, exactly.
So just that kind of a experience.
Right.
It's an activity you can do together, but
right, a bonding thing, like I was saying, yeah.
This is nothing against the younger generation. It's just the way it is.
And like I said earlier, sorry to interrupt, but that's exactly what I meant by we're kind of prisoners of our own time. Like we just don't think, what it might have been like
prior
for another generation.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I agree. I'm going to give you an example of that in just a little bit here. But in addition to that example, that's one with the camera. I mentioned a few minutes ago that my grandfather was a camera buff. And he had the state-of-the-art camera of that time. He also had, for that time, another new technology of that time again, which was called, and this is a dramatic pause. It's not that I forgot. I'm just, I'm making you wait. I'm making you experience the previous generation. Okay, so
there were dramatic pauses all the time in the previous.
Yeah, exactly. We got to wait for the pictures to be developed. It's developing right now. Here we go.
Right. Dramatic.
The technology that I'm talking about is television, which was coming out in the 1950s. Yeah, and there it is. But it was nothing like today's television. I think that the first thing that a present day youth, and I don't remember those generations you rattled off before there,
Gen Z, we'll say.
Oh, Gen Z, okay. If they were walking to a room to check out a vintage TV, the first thing they might notice, I'm assuming they'd notice, would be that the screens are not 50 plus inches and they're not hanging on a wall. And I'm not saying you have to hang your television on a wall, your television screen. In fact, I have one of those large screens now, and it's not hanging on a wall. But back in those days, the television screens were about 12 inches in diameter, and they couldn't hang on a wall because they were encased in a wooden cabinet, which you don't see much of that anymore. But also, the original TVs, they didn't have the flat panel screens like most televisions do today, but they employed what is called a cathode ray tube, which we still have today. They still have their uses. But if you happen to have been around when the computer first became available to the general public to purchase and to have in your home, which wasn't the case when they first came out, but the monitors then were cathode ray tubes of that variety. And they were encased in an encasement that would decrease inside. Now, the front of the monitor was glass, where the user would sit and view the image. And that was the largest dimension of the monitor was in the front, where the screen was. And then as the monitor moved back away from the user, it would decrease in size, not like a cone shape where it's consistently decreasing, but it would, in increments, it would decrease. I was speaking of the computer monitor. I'm going to go back to the television tube, which was kind of shaped the same way, but it's inside of an encasement. Now, the encasement could have been cube-shaped, but the actual tube was more conical in shape. And back toward the back of the tube were electron guns that the television manipulated. There were a couple or maybe three, and these electron guns would beam electrons onto the backside of the screen. And the backside of the screen, which was glass, was phosphorescent, covered with phosphor. When the electron hit the back of the screen, it would illuminate the screen and create the image that the viewer on the front of the out front would see. And the image was actually being painted across the screen, one electron at a time, but at a very rapid pace. To the viewer, it just looked like a continuous image moving. But that's the way it worked. Because the screen was glass and it was being illuminated on the inside, it was visible from the outside.
Right.
Now, this image was black and white only. Sorry, color was not an option, just black and white. But in addition to that, the programming itself was different. Couldn't get up in the middle of the night at any time just because you can't sleep and think I'm going to go turn on some late night TV and expect to see a late night television program. Because programming went off the air, like, say, around midnight. Truthfully, I don't know what time it went off the air. I was always in bed, being, like, between 5 and 8 years old. I don't know what it was. And it didn't come back on till about 7:30 in the morning.
That's another thing that I think would just be unthinkable to people today.
Hard to deal with.
Yeah. Was it the mid-90s when the news became a 24-hour... I don't know if it was CNN that first went to the 24-hour format, but even news, I mean, that's a relatively short time. You go back to the 90s, you know, 20-some years,
right. We
didn't even have news 24 hours. Now we have it, you know, in our pockets whenever we want it. But even that is not a long time ago, relatively speaking, for such an important invention.
Yeah. And to be honest, I don't remember exactly when that happened. It was almost seamless.
Yeah.
It's not like they announced it, you know, that it's going to be 24-hour programming.
It just kind of happened.
It just kind of happened, exactly. Yeah, so the programming didn't come on until about 7:30 in the morning, and I used to get up early on Saturday mornings thinking I was going to watch cartoons or whatever. I was still young. The programming hadn't come on, and this was the late 50s anyway. We had already moved from Los Angeles. When I say we, I'm talking about my parents and I. My brothers weren't born yet. We moved out to Torrance, which is still in Los Angeles County. And I remember getting up in the morning before my parents, this is Saturday morning, turning on the television, and the programming had not come on yet, but they had a test pattern, which was kind of an Indian in black and white.
Right.
And it basically, it was designed to kind of tune your grayscale, because everything was black and white or in between grays. So it was basically for you to tune your television in so it's clear.
Yeah.
But so that's what I dealt with back then. But one evening, I digressed a little bit. but one evening, my grandfather, this is back when we were still in L.A., he, with his television, which I've already revealed that technology, but he wanted to take photos with his latest technology camera. He decided to take photos of a program which he had tuned into on television. Mm-hmm. And why he wanted to do that, I wasn't sure at the time. Honestly, I'm not sure today either, as he passed away in the late 1950s. But I suspect, based on his love for technology, that he wanted to take photos in so he could take them into his co-workers and share, not only kind of show them that he had this great camera, but also that he possessed the latest technology, which was, and I'm not going to give you the dramatic part of time, it's a television.
Right.
But I do have some pictures, some digital copies now, that my brother had digitized a couple weeks ago, of these pictures that my grandfather had taken in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And we, Justin and I, were thinking that it might be a fun thing to do, put them up on our website for anyone who would like to take a look at them. Of course, if you want to do that. And they're kind of cool. They're kind of a look into the past, or as Justin put it, a snapshot of history.
Yeah, maybe we'll call the section on the website a snapshot of history. We'll put all our vintage stuff up there. So.
Yeah, and these particular pictures were interesting because, well, they're not that interesting, but they were kind of interesting in that it looked like a political. I think it was during the Korean War era. Yeah. And they weren't war pictures, but what they were diplomats or ambassadors or I think diplomats meeting, because yeah. You saw like a long desk and each one of the gentlemen, you know, dressed in a suit, he had like a plaque in front of him that would be the name of the country he was representing.
Right.
I remember New Zealand was present there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It might be interesting to you. If anyone has an interest in that, we're going to have them up on the website.
Mm-hmm.
And we did mention that this was kind of going to be a more of a history of technologies, but I am telling you these things, and primarily, like we've mentioned a few times, the younger generations, because there are younger generations out there who have grown up knowing of these present day technologies from your childhood, and you're used to them. Mm-hmm. So, and the technologies that I'm mostly speaking to are the cell phones and computers, desktop and laptops alike, and what's become more commonplace today are the tablets and electronic reading devices. Mm-hmm. And I like the electronic reading devices because I can put whole books on my phone and carry them with me wherever I go whenever I have spare time to read them. Mm-hmm. But even though you may have grown up with the latest technical devices in your home, it doesn't mean you have the latest and greatest. If you have an iPhone or even an Android, you already know they come out with a new version just about every year. And mm-hmm. It gets pretty expensive to keep up with the latest versions. Although there is nothing that they, and when I say they, I'm talking about the manufacturer, would like better than for you to keep up with their technology, because it means they're selling products.
Mm-hmm. I think it would blow like your grandfather away if you were alive today and he saw the technology at people's fingertips. At the same time, I think like the generations today, it's harder to be an early adopter because you have to really be ahead of the curve constantly. Whereas I say all he had to do, but all your grandfather had to do was get this that one big invention that came along every 5-10 years or whatever.
Right.
It's not like that today. So.
But if nothing else, it's an incentive to get a college education.
Sure.
Get paid a little bit more and buy these things.
Yeah.
And just for the record, when I was a kid, there were no cell phones, so I didn't have to worry about that.
Right.
And neither were there computers in the household.
And parents didn't have to worry about that.
Parents didn't have to worry about that. That's true. That's very true. Because now I'm seeing kids that are some relatives whose kids are 5 to 10 years old and they've got cell phones already.
Yeah. Yeah. So a whole nother episode we could do.
Yeah. We probably will not do one on that though. But...
No.
Oh yeah. So when I was a kid, I didn't have a cell phone, and we didn't have cell phones because the technology itself hadn't been developed.
Right.
But I know the government had computers. They always have stuff before we do, because at that time it was the Vietnam War era, and the U.S. had a law in place, which the young guys can be a little more excited about today, because this law was called the draft. I'm not sure whether to really call that a law, but the draft was in place, and the law was that once you reached the age of 18, you had to register for the draft. What the draft meant was that the government could take you and enlist you into the military, unless you were a certain age over. Say where your agent, you're into the 30s already, then you probably didn't have to register. But at that time, I wasn't really too fond of the idea of traipsing through the jungles of Vietnam. And I've just heard horror stories about it and everything. But I decided to just go ahead and enlist in my chosen armed force.
You got ahead of it, basically.
So I chose to go into the Navy, and the ship, after going through boot camp and A school, B school, I was eventually assigned to a ship, but the ship I was on, it had computers on board. Mm-hmm. So I know the government had computers, and large corporations also had computers, because the one company that comes to mind when I think about that is IBM, which is International Business Machines, as they did supply machines to large corporations. And I believe that also included computers. So kind of is why I know that the government had computers.
Right.
And large corporation, but it was limited. It wasn't really a household item at that time. That was came a little bit later. NASA, once Intel hit the scene.
NASA also was
right,
computers
NASA
at a high level back then.
Yeah, they had
what we'd consider back then anyway, a high level.
Yeah, it was, yeah. But you know, just to continue, it's really only been in relatively recent human history that news type information traveled any faster than a horse. Which is in itself hard for me to conceive of, because like we were talking about, being kind of captives of our own generation.
Right.
Since the time I can remember, everyone had a car. So I didn't think anything of it, really. I just figured it'd been around forever. And since we were living in L.A., the L.A. airport, I think we lived kind of in the flight pattern of the planes coming into land, but there were always airplanes flying overhead. So air travel was something that existed already. And people had telephones hanging on the wall or just sitting on a table. And like I said earlier, television was available. But from the era known to us as BC or BCE, which is before Christ or before the Common Era, and just for those of you that don't know, which probably aren't many, but BC refers to before Christ, and BCE is before the Common Era. Both of those designations, they point to the same day in history. Yeah.
Right.
So from that point, BC or BCE, that day, up until the 1800s, travel and likewise information dissemination in the form of news was restricted to the speed of a horse or sailing vessels or a combination of both, really, because if a newsworthy event happened in a region or a city or a town, the event facts would be probably documented in writing on paper and most likely taken to a news agency if they existed back then, where the facts would be written into a story form to be more interesting, and then taken to a newspaper printing press, where it'd be printed and distributed about the city or the area in the form of a newspaper. Mm-hmm. Now, if it was considered newsworthy enough, the news documentation, the facts, would be stuffed into a saddlebag, placed on a horse, and ridden to the next city or town or region, and then go through that same process, being printed on newspaper and redistributed.
Could I say something real quick?
Please.
When the first time you told me this about the horse, I remember thinking, what a strange thought it is that, think of technology, we think of computers and we think of data. And even when we think of information, I think we tend to think of something numerical or words. Or
electronic, yeah.
Yeah, electronic, thank you. We don't think of animals. Or, you know, like
that's true.
The horse is just an animal, a creation of God, obviously. And yet that is part of the history of technology. It's part of the story of information. It's kind of a weird thought because it's not a man-made thing, but it's part of the story. So again, I know we're getting to this, but it kind of makes you think information might not be what we think it is. And that's part of the story.
It's true. In fact, it's a lot more mystical than we think it is. Going back to that information, if the information was really important and it was felt that perhaps it would impact other regions of the country, or even other countries, it would be probably by horse again, taken to the nearest port town, where it'd be transferred onto an outbound ship, and then shipped off to another port town, perhaps further up north or south, to another region of the country, or even another country, would again go through that same process. So it's kind of easy at this point to see that with the lack of technology, this would take quite a bit of time and effort. In other words, the information would move slowly. So speaking of technology and inventions and what we think of technology to be, I'm going to move into something called a steam engine, because that's getting more into a technology of what we would consider to be technology. Mm-hmm. So the very first steam engine recorded is something called an eolipile. You can look this up.
Spell that.
I will spell it, because anyone can look this up on Google. You can Google it and see it for yourself. It's kind of an interesting looking thing, but it's spelled, it sounds like it starts with the letter E, but it does not. It starts with the letter A. So it's spelled A-E-O-L-I-P-I-L-E. I'll spell it one more time, because I know when somebody spells something for me, I'm not usually ready to write. So I'll just give you a few seconds, and then I'll do it again.
Grab your pens.
Yeah. Or your phone, whatever. It's spelled A-E-O-L-I-P-I-L-E. And actually, it's pretty phonetically accurate, as long as you put the A on the front, which is silent. But it was developed in, if you can get this, first century Rome. Now, I was talking about news didn't travel any faster than a horse up until the 1800s, and I'm taking it all the way back to the very first century. Mm-hmm. But the thing about it is that particular steam engine wasn't used in any commercial application. But its primary purpose was to power toys and to amuse visitors.
It looks like I'm looking at it right now. It looks like something like a miniature version anyway, you would put on your desk. Like, it just kind of looks like a plaything kind of for adults, but.
Right. I'm trying to think of what
it's hard to describe.
It's kind of a spherical looking thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't have it in front of me right now, so I don't remember, but I'm trying to think of, what's the giant?
A gyroscope or
not a gyroscope, but it used to be a thing that would balance on a string. You'd spin it. Might not even know, Justin, because I don't think they.
Yeah, that one might be before mine.
It was before your time. It was a toy, but it wasn't a steam power toy. It was something you put a string around, almost like a yo-yo, and you'd spin it, and it would balance. Mm. You could actually put it on a string and balance it. It would stay because it was spinning.
Yeah.
You can spin it on a tabletop or a floor or on something small. But it was kind of an interesting thing. But that's what it looks like.
I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what it's called. Yeah.
You probably can go into a toy store and find them today. But so we're digressing a little bit here. But so I want to admit that when I first read this about the steam engine powering a toy, I thought it was kind of strange. I thought about it a little bit more, and then I realized that even today, companies have R&D, which are research and development departments, who work primarily on the same premise, because nowadays we do have toys that are self-powered and self-playing, if you will.
Right.
They look exciting on television, as if the child can do all these great things with them. And I know, as a kid, I've been there. I get excited about, oh man, does this and does that. But you get them home, you put the batteries in it, turn it on, and the toy does all those things that it was designed to do. But in reality, it does all the playing. And as a kid, you just sit there and watch it.
Right.
And before you know it, and $60 later, you're bored.
Yeah, those tend to be the toys that don't make
There's no interaction, yeah.
Right.
So, they're
the coolest toys, but they don't engage.
They don't fulfill the purpose.
Right.
To keep you occupied, basically. But it's interesting, though, sadly interesting, how TV commercials have a way of glamorizing anything and everything, So I'm going to sticking with the steam engine. The first experimental steam-powered vehicles appeared around 1800s. So I just jumped 1,800 years ahead from the first century, from the first year.
I just was one thing real quick. It's interesting that that's a Roman invention, because when you think of Rome, and we're going to bring Rome back later in future episodes, but they were very advanced for their time. Obviously, you know, they're the fourth great world empire, and they really pushed technology along in their time. In different ways. And it's funny how like something like this just never found an application, which is another interesting thing about information. It's not just about where, how should I say this? Like where a society is technology wise. It's, there's a lot of other factors that come into play as to what becomes a useful invention. Because if you think about the horse, it's just something that again was just part of creation. The horse was around already.
It was there,
and it became this technological vehicle, and then, you know, this really complex man-made invention just sat around for thousands of years and never accomplished anything. So kind of off topic, but it's just a weird thought.
That is interesting, because the Romans were pretty ingenious. You know, they developed shields that they could use as walls for their army advancing. You know, reflect, they could build a wall that would protect them against oncoming arrows and sort of things.
Right.
So they had a lot of ingenuity.
Yeah. And we're going to, again, I don't want to give away everything we're going to talk about later, but, you know, they had a lot of innovation directly related to information, such as the roads they constructed. We'll talk about this more, but kind of the network of, and the, of roads and the, and
what,
the,
what do you call it?
The codex.
Codex, the
manuscript, you know, the ancient manuscript form that they used, which disseminated writing more quickly. So they were instrumental in increasing the speed of information, not to the level, of course, that we're talking about here, the last couple of centuries.
That's true.
But it is interesting that this invention just kind of fell by the wayside.
Okay, so I'm going to return to that steam engine. The first experimental steam-powered vehicles now appeared around 1800. And these steam-powered vehicles could be used independent of rails, which we're not used to seeing nowadays. Not just as we would know them today, being restricted to rails, but they were used in a steam car, and there was also a steam wagon. Vehicles were also used for agriculture, kind of doing some of the heavy hauling work. But the first experimental vehicles, cars, were built in the 18th, which is the 1700s, and the 19th century. But it was not until the use of high-pressure steam around 1800 that mobile steam engines became practical and were used for commercial considerations.
Right.
Now, in the first half of the 19th century, which again is the early 1800s, there was a lot of progress in using the steam vehicles. And by 1850, which is halfway through that century, they were produced commercially. This is where the government enters in. They dampened, by legislation, they limited and prohibited the use of steam-powered vehicles on the road, which may explain why we don't see them on the road today. We see them, they're on railroad tracks.
Right.
However, they're not steam-powered anymore. They're diesel-powered. So it is still a little different. But the in the early 1800s, the high-pressure steam engine was used in the early steam-powered locomotive. So we're getting into a little bit higher technology here, introducing the locomotive.
That's what people think of when they think of the steam engine.
They
think of the locomotive.
Probably the first thing you think of. But even they aren't, even they are now steam-powered. I mean,
they're diesel-powered. Right. Yeah.
But the first high-pressure steam engine was used in the early steam locomotive in the early 1800s. And the first steam-powered locomotive itself was introduced in 1804. So that's pretty early 1800s. And that came after the first trial of the steam locomotive, which in the first trial, it was able to carry 10 tons of iron and 70 men for more than 9 miles. But it took them 4 hours and 5 minutes, which, you know, doesn't sound all that impressive to us nowadays.
Well, it sounds like Southern California traffic, basically.
Yeah. At the right hour, right? 5 o'clock.
Yeah, 4 to 5 hours, go 9 miles.
So think of that as a ponderous-sounding journey this locomotive took. Even though it took that long, it was still the first step toward an invention that would completely change man's relationship to time and space. And the reason that it changed man's relationship is because for the first time in history, it enabled man to travel faster than the speed of a horse. That was a big invention, big moment.
Yeah.
So right there, The fact that man was able to travel faster than the speed of horse, it illustrates or demonstrates how technology is playing a part in moving information more quickly. Now, this is speaking still primarily of news-type information, and we said this was going to be directed, at least in the future, toward information science, and we're moving in that direction. But there is, I want to reassure you that there is a common thread between all the information, and what we're aiming to get at is what is information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back to the 1800s, then what became known as the railroad was then used to carry mail and news as well as people across the country. And at that point, information dissemination had become a combination of railway and horse delivery.
Mm.
So the horse was still in the picture. Mm-hmm. They were still necessary.
So this is like the pivot point of history, it's, in a sense, going
it's
from
one the, of the pivot points. Yeah.
Going from the natural world, the horse, to sort of the man-made technologies of transportation.
So it's kind of a hybrid.
Right. I mean, right. Exactly.
But
not,
we can see,
not what we think of as hybrid today, but
not quite, no. But somewhat, yeah.
But we can lesser, see that. The lesser known horse railway hybrid.
But yeah, speaking of that token, we can see where moving information around was being affected by developing technology.
Mm-hmm.
But the greatest advancements were still yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about and take note of these dates, because it was in 1876 in Germany when the first four-stroke gasoline engine was invented. It was in 1876. So then in 1886, which is just 10 years later, Carl Benz, you've heard of the Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
You may own one or may covet one. I don't know, but it was built first. Carl Benz built the first commercially produced motor vehicles with that internal combustion engine. And then that was 1886. So just 4 years later, 1890, the motorized vehicles had reached their modern stage of development, which led to the increasing of the speed by which news could be disseminated around the country, or at least from one place to another, but still not transcontinentally.
Right.
We didn't have then, and we don't have still today, the technology to build a bridge, or I think what would be more practical, but it's not going to happen, build a causeway that spans the ocean. And I believe that would be way too impractical for today, and we're not going to digress back to that time.
What's the difference between a bridge and a causeway?
Well, a bridge, it's like they have a suspension bridge, more or less. It has stanchions that hold it up, where a causeway has pillars, basically. The causeway is more like right over the surface of the ocean.
Yeah.
Over the water. They have causeways in Florida, it would be monumental. Logistic nightmare, I think, to build a causeway that spans the ocean, because that's like 2,000 miles, I think, or maybe more. It'd be a rather boring trip. You'd have to have gas stations and even motels along the way.
Yeah. You know, what's weird about that is it conjures up like this sci-fi image in your head when you think of, driving across the ocean in like a glass bubble or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's actually a very backward thinking technology now.
It is for now, because we have air travel now. Who's going to want to drive 2,000 miles across the ocean when you can get on a plane and be there in a couple hours,
Right.
Well, more than a couple, but not necessary.
Right.
Okay, so I want to go back to the earlier, not real early, but earlier part of the 1800s. 1830 to be exact, because that's when the telegraph was invented by Samuel Morse.
Mm-hmm.
At that time then, once the telegraph and the Morse code was invented, we were able to send information across the country, still not transcontinentally for other reasons. We were able to send it across the country through wires, which is a clue as to where we're headed. It's a clue as to the mystery of information, because what we had thought of as information up to that time as being something that you could hold in your hand and see was now being sent through wires. And we weren't sending newspapers through wires. So if that be the case, the question is, what is this information really? What is it?
Yeah.
It doesn't fit the MO.
Yeah. I feel like that's the most significant invention of everything you're describing, at least as it pertains to what we're talking about.
Yeah, so you've gone from what we were talking about, the hybrid horse and machine, into a whole nother level.
Yeah, but you're also going from sort of like a written form of information, which is what I think most people think of, either something you read, like information, or something that's nowadays, of course, because of television, we think of like the inputted image of news and stuff. But
right.
But this was the point in history where it sort of became this non-tangible thing that's traveling, like you said, traveling across wires. And I don't know if people understood the significance of it at the time, but when you look back,
probably not.
Yeah, when you look back, it's like that was really significant, because it gets to the heart of kind of what we're talking about here. What is it exactly that information is?
Yeah, and then in 1901, so we're gonna go on another level here.
Mm-hmm.
Guglielmo Marconi, he successfully transmitted the first transoceanic wireless telegraphy across the Atlantic. We were just talking about information traveling through wires. So at that point, we no longer even needed wires. we're transmitting information through the air,
right?
Which further mystifies it, because right. It's traveling through the air. And if you were standing outside the telegraph office, you would not see information leaving the building.
Yeah.
It's actually leaving. It's over the airways. Right. So that's a whole nother level of what is information, which I'm excited to get into episode 2, because we're going to get more into exactly why that is and what it is and some of the discoveries, scientific take on what's going on there.
Right.
But yeah, go ahead.
And another thought, I mean, just fast forward to the 60s, 1969, we had the moon landing.
Right.
And, you know, you're talking about here how information now is traveling roughly the speed of light, right? You're getting to the point where it's traveling that quickly. And so you get to the point where someone's on, you know, on the moon, and they're transmitting, and we're hearing it here in the United States. Just think of how mind-boggling that was for people at that time. And to this day, I mean, there's people that think that the moon landing was staged. I'm sure partly because, you know, we think of the 60s as kind of an archaic in term compared to today, but they already had the technology, not just to send someone to the moon, but to, you know, communicate with people instantaneously,
yeah,
or almost instantaneously. So going back to the telegraph, I think that was like kind of a clue as to how quickly information could be transmitted, but it starts to get exponential at this point when you get into the 19th and 20th centuries.
And that's exactly why we're going over this history that encompasses 2 centuries, because that's when information really started to explode, more or less.
Right.
Or technology, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And the technologies are important to understand what information is, and just to understand this part of information and how it went from something being printed on newspaper and spread to now where we're hearing it over the airways on television. And when you think about it, everybody, I think everyone probably listening, and maybe not everyone, but yeah, I think everyone listening probably has a television. So it's kind of amazing how you can go into up to your television and say, I'm going to turn on the television. You turn it on, and maybe there's a news program or some kind of a programming on there, and it more or less instantaneously appears. And you may watch 2-3 minutes of it. And I know for me, like, I might watch a couple minutes of a baseball game and think, I'm not really interested in these 2 teams. I'd rather watch these other 2 teams. So you just hit a button, and now you're watching 2 different teams.
Yeah.
So
a 1,000 miles away.
Yeah, 1,000 miles away. So my point is here is that information is coming across airwaves. It's in your house, and you might have an antenna outside. Now, more or less, we have satellite dishes. So the information is being transmitted up to a satellite and back down, coming into your home. But I have like over 100 channels on my television, and all those channels, all that information is coming into my house at one time.
Yeah.
And I'm just switching around. But the thing is, I can't see any of it. I just happen to have a device that is sensitive to it and will tune it in and amplify it.
Right.
So that information is all there, and yet we don't see it.
Yeah,
that's my point. It's surrounding all of us. So the question is, what is it?
Right.
That's our mystery. But
We're getting there. And
yeah, I was talking about Marconi, how he had successfully transmitted the first wireless telegraphy across the ocean. So now we were able to send information wirelessly in transcontinentally. Now, Marconi is also credited with having founded the first use of radio.
Mm.
And once the radio became established in our culture, it was close to real-time information delivery system, being that radio waves travel at the speed of electricity, which is roughly the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some interesting things surrounding the speed of light, too. And some point down the line, we're going to get to episodes talking about that. So at the same time, then, both these things happened at the same time that we were able to transmit information to ships at sea or, mm-hmm. and or, I should say, transcontinentally. So that's kind right. of a pivot point also in right. This whole story.
Right.
Jumping to 1914 or the 1900s, 1914 specifically, World War I broke out, during which time the airplane was initially used for reconnaissance reasons in the war, being that it was fought in trenches. And because it was in trenches, it was more of a static nature, didn't move real fast. But because the war was fought in trenches, aircraft was the only means by which information of the enemy positions could be in trenches could be gathered. So they were used essentially for discovering where the enemy was based and what they were doing.
Mm.
So this was another technological advancement here, because the Wright brothers had made their historic flight only a decade before World War One. But during the war, sometimes it takes a war to do this kind of stuff, but large advances made in the aviation field. Because the planes then and their instruments were very crude, to say the least. To illustrate that, anyone can go on Google today and look up photos of crew members of these planes. And there were really only two crew members in these military planes. There was one, the pilot, of course, and another crew member sitting behind the pilot in his own open cockpit. But the demonstration, this guy in the back seat is holding a bomb out over the edge of the plane, going to drop it on the enemy. Now, the picture isn't of one in the air being demonstrated in real time, but it's just a static picture. They're sitting on the ground, and he's just showing how they dropped the bombs, basically, mm-hmm. by hand, which was pretty crude.
Mm-hmm. Was that, I'm assuming that technology or that lack of technology changed by World War II, right? Because they weren't the atomic bombs like that. No. Okay.
Again,
that's a relatively short. It's only 20 years between the two wars.
Right, sadly enough. Yeah, but
yeah,
that's true. They had the bomb bays then that opened. Well, I think they opened them mechanically, but
they were able to
release the bombs, and
they didn't have somebody holding the atomic bomb.
No. By that time, the bombs were very heavy. I don't think anyone could hold them. Yeah, that's a good point. But and now comes my cynical statement, leave it to mankind to take a great invention, and I'm talking about the airplane itself, take that great invention and convert it into an offensive weapon. But it did prove to be a very effective weapon, and the British used it against the Germans and vice versa. And once the rest of the countries caught on to that, it wasn't long before they all joined into the pursuit of building what we know today as being an air force. So what that equates to is we have all become one big happy family, capable of causing destruction to each other when, by our judgment, we feel it's necessary. But, you know, later in the 1900s, air travel did become more prominent, which made airmail part of our culture, and it also paved the way for faster transoceanic travel. I think most of us know of Charles Lindbergh, who made the first solo transoceanic flight. And since then, transoceanic deliveries also became more commonplace.
Earlier, I might have sounded critical of the Gen Z generation for their lack of patience, I guess, one way to say it. But I have to admit, like, when you talk about, you're mentioning air mail.
Yeah.
I think of myself, like, I get so impatient when a package doesn't arrive the next day, or like 2 days almost seems like a long time now for something to come overseas.
Yeah.
So really, I mean, it's affected everyone. It's not today.
It's not just a generation. It's just a human condition. Yeah.
Right.
I know that's so true, because recently, and I'm not plugging Amazon, but recently they've you know, that if you're a Prime member, you can get a delivery in one day.
Yeah.
So now, yeah, if it takes 2 days, I'm impatient.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah.
So apologies to the younger guys.
Sorry, yeah. Gen Z. No offense. We're there with you.
But today we do have, like you're talking about, today we do have electronic transmission and news information. And we can consider the radio and television as being part of that electronic information transmission. You know, yet we still are on a whole new level with the internet and the independent news outlets. Outlets are primarily over the internet. And of course, we have the cell phone. I confess to having one. Cell phone, and probably everyone out there that's listening has a cell phone, maybe listening to this podcast on cell phone. Mm-hmm. But of all this real-time electronic transmission advancement, and when I say real-time, I'm talking about more or less instantaneous, has been within my lifetime. Mm. So basically, considering I'm still alive, all this real-time news information dissemination has happened within the one generation, which happens to be my generation. So I'm right there with everybody else. But before going any further, I want to make it clear that to everyone that the purpose of this podcast series, not this episode, but the series, is to address biological information and information science. But it's at this point that we're laying a foundation to show how technology enters into the picture as far as being able to research and understand the significance of biological information and why it takes technology, which is why we went over all this technology, and there's more to come, to more deeply see and understand the importance of biological information and to address the question of the origin of first life.
That's a great summary. Thanks for going through all that history. Yeah, I just want to go back to one thing you mentioned as we wrap up here. You talked about, and you said you were being cynical, and maybe you were, but speaking of history, man has a history of sort of taking great inventions, like you said, and not just converting them into weapons, as you mentioned, but finding a negative use for them, or let's just say a negative use can come out of any invention, and that includes all of this technology explosion we're seeing today. You mentioned cell phones. Cell phones introduce a whole new set of problems. You know, attention spans, like we mentioned, have gotten shorter. I think, you know, there's...
Oh, not to mention driving while texting.
Yeah, new forms of danger. So there you have it. That's what you might call a brief history of information, to borrow from Stephen Hawking. I think you said earlier, Dad, that we were sort of whetting people's appetite. So I think it would be a good idea to kind of end on a little teaser. I want to tie this episode into the title of our podcast, Truth Alone. So in Matthew 24:35, Jesus says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." So speaking of information, what it is, there's another clue. When he refers to his words, he seems to be referring to scripture. In John 16:17, he says, "Sanctify them in your truth. Your word is truth." So if you take these two scriptures together, notice that the words word and truth are used interchangeably. Your word is truth. Now we jump back to John 1:1. We read that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the word here is used as a reference to Jesus. So if we take all three verses together now, we see that Jesus is the Word, and therefore we can conclude that Jesus is truth, right? Because the Word is truth. Jesus is the Word, so therefore Jesus is truth itself. So needless to say, this has big implications in general, but it has big implications when it comes to the topic of information as well. So how do we reconcile that with all the misinformation that's out there? Because obviously, we live in an age when it's become difficult to trust the majority, some would argue, of our media sources. So where is God in all that? Someone might ask. Well, remember what Joseph told his brothers in Genesis 50. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. So that same idea is seen throughout Scripture. It's essentially the theme of the whole redemption story, right up to the present day, right into our individual lives. And it's probably best articulated in a verse that most of you already know, Romans 8:28. And we know that for those that love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. So that also means, by extension, that God is using all these historical developments we just discussed in this episode for the last hour to redeem humanity. He's using those things to redeem humanity, ultimately, in his way, in his time. in his sovereignty. And that's a pretty mind-blowing thought, maybe a little tough to wrap our minds around, but probably a good way to end our first show, just to leave you with something to chew on. So there you have it. And that's our show for today. I want to say thank you again to everyone listening. On behalf of my dad, Robin Moranti, I want to invite you all to join us for episode 2. We're going to start to really get into information science itself and how it's having a profound impact on the scientific community and how it should be having a profound impact on our worldview as Christians in the world today. So thank you again. Join us next time for another episode of the Truth Alone podcast.